Hello, and welcome to episode 82 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
It was about at this time 3 years ago when all of us learned a lot more about pandemics. As the coronavirus surged across the world, many felt overwhelmed with the avalanche of information about the virus. Each day, news reports showed an escalation of new cases and new deaths. We know a lot more about COVID today, and because of vaccines and previous infections, most people are much better protected. Although it can still be a deadly disease, it's no longer affecting how most of us live our lives. Rick, having lived through the pandemic for the past 3 years, are you confident that we'll be better prepared for when the next one strikes?
Fairly confident. I mean, I wish we were doing more to be better prepared, but I think, for example, I think many of our county agencies are much better prepared than they were 3 years ago for dealing with the next one. I think a lot of our healthcare systems, hospitals and clinics, at the local level, I think they're much more prepared than they were before for dealing with the pandemic now. I don't have as much confidence in our kind of state and national governments, and I wish we were doing more there, but I guess we'll get into that in
a
few minutes.
Yeah, well, and the other thing I would say why we might be in a little better position is that, you know, I certainly don't have a public health background. I never really thought about pandemics before this all. And so like things about like, you know, just the sort of public health apparatus that was dropped on top of us with, shutdowns and vaccines and testing and all of that was sort of a language a lot of us all had to learn, and the positivity rates and all those things. And I think next time we'll at least be able to speak that language again. Hopefully we won't. Hopefully it's 100 years from now and we'll all be dead and another generation has to deal with this. But assuming it's not that long, that we'll all be in a better place to talk about things and kind of maybe have a little better sense of what to expect. My take, and this is where I think some of the problem came in how we approached all of this, is that COVID was certainly deadly. We all know that. And the numbers were especially bad if you were elderly or had certain high-risk conditions. But at the same time, we all know someone who has had COVID. Probably most people listening have had COVID. I think I'm not telling any secrets. Rick and I have both had COVID. Rick and I did not die. And most people we know did not die. And I think because the death rate was tragic, but not something that affected each and every one of us in overwhelming ways, it really let us approach this in kind of two disparate ways. That you had people who would say, this is serious, this is bad, by the time this is all done, millions of people will have died, so we need to be really careful about how we proceed. And then there were people who would legitimately say in their mind that most people are going to be fine, that it's something we should all be, I guess, aware of, but we shouldn't let it affect our everyday lives, because especially if you're, not older than 70 or don't have a couple of particular medical cases, you're probably going to be just fine. And, that's probably true. So it just sort of threaded this needle where it was bad, but it wasn't like ridiculously bad. And what makes me worried a bit is, imagine if the next virus that comes across is like 10 times more deadly. I mean, I would hope change people's behavior a lot, but I worry that it might not.
Well, I think it would. If it were that much worse, I think, just based on what you said, we would all have more kind of direct evidence of the virus's effect in a case like that. And so it would make it harder for people who are discounting the seriousness of it to be seen as plausible. And yet, I don't know. I mean, we have shown a remarkable resistance to kind of fact and perspective as a, you know, as a public.
And even if it were 10 times worse, I mean, that would be an unimaginable death toll. At the same time, most people who would get it would survive. So, I mean, there would still be that argument made. I mean, in my mind, a real winning argument, but it would be made.
Yeah, and I think many of us at least knew somebody or knew people who knew others who were working in healthcare settings for whom, you know, they spent a year and a half in very difficult circumstances and just being completely overwhelmed. And yet, even at that time, people were dismissing it as not being all that serious. And it was so hard during that, you know, it's interesting to look back on that now, but at the time, it was so hard to carry on these conversations because you had people exaggerating on both ends, exaggerating how bad it was and others who were kind of dismissing all of it as hyperbole. And the truth was somewhere in the middle, but it also affected kind of different populations in very different ways.
Yeah, you know, if I were an 80-year-old, I would have lived the last 3 years much differently than I did as someone who's, you know, not 80. I mean, that's just the fact of the matter. And I think that'd probably be the same for you, too.
Absolutely. And I know people who are still quite cautious because they have, you know, legitimate health concerns that I think really require them to be extra cautious about COVID. And yet I'm also, you know, I was also on a campus, I think, compared to many others. I think our campus did a fairly good job of imposing kind of moderate kind of constraints for a while. But, you know, we returned fairly quickly to having classes in person, although we were wearing masks and so forth. But there were other campuses in the country that put bans on any traveling outside of dorm rooms, even outside with masks on was forbidden on some campuses. Like there was no point to it. And so then you kind of think, well, the exaggeration of the virus and what ought to be done is going on both sides, on both the right and the left here.
And I think that there's been some certainly mistrust about how the CDC handles it. A recent poll found that a quarter of Americans, in fact, distrust CDC recommendations. I think my position on that is I don't think at any time any message was coming from leaders at the CDC in bad faith. I think they were doing the best they could with the knowledge they had. But And of course, people will point to masking and how at first that wasn't a good idea in the CDC's minds, and then all of a sudden was. And I don't necessarily want to go and relitigate all those discussions. But I think what you mentioned is right, though, about, you know, there were campuses where they wouldn't even allow masked students out walking around outside to get exercise or just spend time outside. And in retrospect, I wish the CDC would have pushed back a little bit and said, you know what, not to name particular campuses, but saying, here are the things that are, we can't promise you that, you know, if a million people do this, maybe one or two people might come back with a case of COVID, but almost assuredly, these are going to be fairly safe things. And I don't think they gave enough guidance to what you could do, along with the long list of appropriate things that you shouldn't be doing.
The CDC was remarkably silent with a lot of, not just recommendations. I mean, they had some recommendations. I found them kind of confusing and vague. Some were overly detailed, overly explicit, so it was hard to kind of read through and figure out like how they applied to all the different circumstances, and others were just vague. And that left a lot of like businesses and other kinds of organizations figuring things out for themselves. Because one of the things that the CDC did not do is allow access to their scientists for people to ask questions. So like I think they had something like during the Trump years, maybe 18 or 19 kind of media events where they, over
press conferences,
teleconferences. they only had a handful of these, you know, and you're thinking, oh, like over a 2-year period, why not, you know, why aren't they meeting every week or every couple weeks? Because the data was changing all the time and new questions were coming up. And so people were going to all kinds of other experts because you couldn't talk to the CDC. You know, you'd have press releases, you'd have the director of the CDC being questioned, but they've got all these scientists who are in touch with governments and scientific organizations all over the world saying like the most up-to-date information. Why couldn't they be transparent about what they're finding, what they're investigating, kind of where there's some kind of certainty and where there's uncertainty? I think that would have been very helpful.
I mean, I don't know if it would have been, just because I think most of those people in those professions are just trained to be like hyper careful about every single thing. And I think that, you know, it's like if you talk to a dietitian, they're not going to ever tell you to go out and have a medium rare steak. They're going to tell you to have your veggies and bran flakes. And we all know we should eat more veggies and we should all eat more bran flakes. But we also know that occasionally we want a steak, or many of us might want a steak from time to time. And I think the CDC could have been much better positioned if they would have had talked about things more like saying that this is an aerosolized disease or virus, and that it is almost exclusively spread being in close proximity to someone who has the virus. It gets aerosolized through coughing or just through breathing, and you get that into your lungs and off you go. And at the same time, when I think like smart scientists knew this, there were people out there who were like washing off the mail and the newspaper when it got delivered to their home. And I think in my mind, a smart CDC, although maybe this is beyond their capacity, because maybe, again, there might be that 1 in 1,000 chance that you're going to, if the mail carrier just sneezed on that envelope and put it in your box, and then you pick up that envelope and then you just immediately touch your eye. I mean, who knows what could happen? But like, if that was the only way COVID was transmitted, we wouldn't have had a pandemic. It was an aerosolized virus. And if they would have just been more clear about that and said, you know, this is sort of nonsense, these, what people are doing, and all these, you know, don't touch here, don't touch there stuff was just way overblown. But I don't remember ever a time that of the CDC saying, you know, here's where we might have thought originally that these were things you had to do, but now that we've learned more and it's been a couple of months, this is the stuff you don't have to worry about, because there's plenty to worry about. But these things you don't have to worry about. And I don't think that ever happened.
No, it happened from others, yeah. Other experts. There was, you know, there was those studies that were done fairly early on about the effectiveness of different kinds of masks. I think that was at Duke or University of North Carolina. It was an East Coast university that did those studies. But this didn't come from the CDC. Johns Hopkins set up their tracking website because the CDC wasn't prepared to do it. Mm-hmm. And that was
sort of the de facto authoritative source for nearly 3 years was what Johns Hopkins put out.
Right. And like, I just remember the CDC being late to the game with just about all of the crucial information. And then they would weigh in on something to do with a recommendation that then became, you know, like standard for many of our healthcare facilities and for county health and human service agencies, county health departments, basically being ignored by many other places because many places were already adapting to the latest information before the CDC would issue its recommendations. And it seems to me this is the mission for which the CDC was founded, was to protect us, to track and protect us from infectious diseases, that this should be forefront in what they do. But then they also should be the leader in when people have questions, legitimate questions about what's going on, like what are you paying attention to, what are you tracking on? And this is important, not just because it's important for us as a public to know, it's important for the CDC as the people's agency for this pandemic to know what kinds of questions we're asking. I mean, we had a lot of bright people asking all kinds of questions. I found it fascinating to follow this and cover, you know, read all these, you know, different scientific papers and read journalists' interpretations of the data. But all this was going on independent of the CDC. The CDC was a missing voice in most of the conversations about the kind of the latest scientific findings of the disease.
So you had that going on. I think we both agree in general about that and how, I guess, maybe we're not surprised about that poll that shows about a quarter of Americans distrust the CDC even today. At the same time, when this was going on in the first, we'll say, year of the pandemic, you also had the president at the time, Donald Trump, who was trying to take a moment, which I think I'm still convinced that would have been a perfect time to boost his reputation, that there was a pretty easy playbook here that nobody wants to get sick. We all want to fight this together. This is something that, you know, just kind of dropped on top of us, and we're all going to rally together, work together, and overcome, that he quickly politicized. And that certainly also did not help. A story that just came out a couple of weeks ago, looking back at the third anniversary of all this, Eric Topol, who I have found, by the way, to be a tremendously valuable voice throughout the pandemic on Twitter and other places, was quoted by the Associated Press as saying, quote, "I wish we had united against the enemy, the virus, instead of against each other." I personally lay a fair amount of that blame at then President Trump. Is that misplaced?
No, I think, like, we've all known this is part of President Trump's kind of political strategy is to kind of identify enemies. I mean, everything is a contest. So there's very little talk in his, I would say, like, the word collaboration is just not in his vocabulary. And even my criticism of the CDC, some of that is, I think some blame can be placed at the feet of Donald Trump for that, because the director of the CDC made some remarks at a press conference in February indicating that this is going to be a real serious concern, and the stock market, you know, went down several points immediately following that, you know, those remarks. And reportedly Trump wanted to have the CDC director fired immediately. And while that will cause a kind of a chilling effect to go throughout the agency, saying maybe we should step back from our kind of public engagement on this. And so in some ways that's understandable. But yeah, Trump had an opportunity here to provide, you know, like, really good leadership. And I think if he'd done that, I think if he had not kind of used this as another opportunity for trying to find political advantage and further politicizing all kinds of things, he probably would have been reelected.
I think that's right. And I'm going to draw maybe a somewhat awkward comparison. A pandemic and a war, while not the same thing, are both big events in country's history. And I remember during World War, I don't remember, I wasn't around, but I remember reading about World War II. And Franklin Roosevelt got a lot of credit for bringing the country together at the time of war. But the specific part I want to kind of hone in on was the president, Roosevelt, asked for the Americans to make sacrifices. There was rationing that was going on, and some of that was important because he made people build fewer cars because we needed those raw materials to build tanks and other tools of war, and other food was rationed because we needed to make sure that our fighting men overseas got the food they needed. I've read as well, though, that other rationings that were put out there were also maybe somewhat about the war effort, but also some way to make Americans all feel like they were sacrificing in a way for a greater good. And all Americans really wanted to try to play a role into defeating this. We just did not have that same unity around the coronavirus. And in some ways, we had more personal control. Our behaviors actually, in some ways, I would argue, mattered more than it might have been how we rationed rice back in that time. Has society just changed so much that a shared sacrifice is looked at skeptically, or did we not have the leadership in place to make that shared sacrifice seem appropriate?
Well, we had a very polarizing leadership, and I would say that wasn't just Donald Trump. I mean, the Democratic leadership was quite polarizing too, and used this at crucial points over the last few years to gain political advantage. And so, I don't think we had the necessary leadership. And by the way, I'll mention that since Biden's been in office, I think the CDC has only had 2 press conferences. It's not that they've gotten any better under the new leadership, but also like the social circumstances have changed so much. I don't think it's possible anymore to have a government that would successfully mislead us about the need to do certain kinds of sacrifices that were manipulation, that were just to make us feel a sense of unity, but that weren't really needed. They would all be questioned. And we'd have some sources that would point out that these aren't really needed. This is used to manipulate you.
And I'm going to make a guess here, and I don't know this to be true, but my strong assumption would be is that if the press, which looked much differently back then than it did today, found out that this was happening, they may have felt their duty bound to not report that, to not say that, well, in fact, have all the, again, making up a scenario here, but all the rice you want, because it doesn't make any difference. This rationing is just sort of a way to galvanize the country together. My sense is that if that reporter would have come back to the New York Times and said, hey, I got an A1 story for tomorrow's paper, I don't know if it would have run back then. It sure would run today.
Yeah, you know, our government agencies are so much more attuned to how to do messaging, how to do successful messaging. And so they aren't just reporting on what their findings are, what their kind of their own recommendations to themselves would be. It all goes through a kind of marketing kind of campaign and a deliberation about how will this be perceived? What will be the effects on the agency? What will be the effects on the administration?
What will people say on Twitter?
Exactly. And at the same time, we're all well aware of that. So we're all a little bit skeptical of any messaging that comes to us because we know that this has been carefully crafted to appear in a certain light. And so we're never just getting the unvarnished truth. We're not hearing, for example, how they would talk to one another. I think this is why I said earlier, I wish that we could just speak, or at least representatives from the media, talk directly to some scientists from the CDC, like how are they talking to one another about what's going on, instead of like, what is the press release?
What's the message tested? Answer.
Yeah, because that automatically makes us skeptical of it and sets up a division from those who are, you know, trusting of the administration than those who are not. I don't know if there's a good way out of that. And that this is the thing that makes me less confident about whether we're, you know, more or less prepared for dealing with the next pandemic, is that we've all become more cynical about messaging in general. And yet, in times like this, the messages we receive from, you know, key institutions is really important to get us, you know, to do some kind of unified action.
The other probably biggest topic over the past couple of weeks, as we have hit the 3-month anniversary, is yet again re-examining of where COVID all started. And initially, official scientific opinion was that this was something that made a leap from a likely a wet market in Wuhan, which I always want to remind people is a huge, huge, huge city in China. This is not some small town. This is I believe it's the size of New York City, if not maybe larger. I mean, it's a very large city. But nonetheless, that's where the first outbreak was. Many people thought it was around this wet market, and there have been previous examples in these places where there'll be a virus that jumps from animal to human. And that was sort of where the consensus was amongst really all mainline mainstream science, is that's where this happened. At the same time, there were a few people pointing out saying, well, also in that same city is also one of the very few laboratories where they study the coronavirus and have been doing work on this. And there's also been instances around the world in similar labs where, you know, they may try real hard to not let the virus out, but mistakes happen, and that this could have been what's now called the lab leak theory. Initially, and I think maybe for almost the first year of the pandemic, that mainstream scientists continually shot down that theory, even though China, of course, not surprisingly, was very not transparent about trying to let other people come in and investigate this. And as time has gone by, there have been a number of investigations into this by the Department of Energy, most recently by the United States, who say there is a likelihood that it probably did come from the lab, although there have also been other studies by other governmental agencies that say no, probably the wet market theory is the best. It's interesting, though, how it has evolved over the past 3 years and how the conversation has evolved. Even Dr. Fauci, who's now retired, but was sort of the face of this pandemic response, his position on this has changed, where he's now, I think his position currently is both are legitimate avenues to look at, although he's convinced we may never know exactly where it all began. Is there anything, I guess, that we can learn from this? Because I think initially, if you were suggesting that it was an accidental leak from a lab, there were some people making allegations that you were making racist claims, that you were just being irrational, that you were not listening to the scientists. And as time goes by, it sounds like there's not a lot of agreement about that.
So it's hard to know, like, what was actually going on within the CDC at the time. You know, so when you have organizations that come out with a message and they're saying all of our scientists think that this is the answer and it's the only kind of responsible answer and everything else is misinformation, then like, if you trust the agency, you want to go along with that. And I think what we found since is that there is probably much more dissension within the scientific community than we were led to believe. It's not just that, like, several scientists have since changed their minds because new evidence has come to light, although that's the case with some. It turns out there were a number of reputable scientists who had their doubts and several who were saying all along to their colleagues, we really don't know. Like, either one is a possibility. We don't have enough information yet. And this is the problem with these organizations that are supposed to kind of represent us and we're supposed to trust, being too concerned about the messaging. I think not wanting to simply say, we don't have enough information yet. We're still looking into the possibilities. And I think, you know, lots of times, you know, you get people that are the heads of these agencies who are spokespeople, and they don't want to just say, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what they should say. I mean, it's because this is the scientific response to most things is like we have an hypothesis, we're looking into it, but we're always open to, you know, counter evidence. This is how we proceed. We put forth a hypothesis. We test it. We look for inconsistencies or, you know, other possible explanations, and then we revise our hypothesis. This is how we proceed. And so the most common answer to the question is, well, I think it could be this way or this way, but I really don't know for sure. And yet we don't get those kinds of public statements. And I think we would have been much better served if Dr. Fauci and others had said, it could be either one.
But I also think it matters, though. And I'm sure there's people listening who say, well, why does it matter? I mean, obviously, unless we, I think there's only a sliver of people who think this was could be of an intentional act. I don't think there's not a lot of people who believe that. So we'll set that aside. But if it was, you know, this the wet market angle, or if it was the lab leak, it matters, because if it was this something that happened in an open market, and there are things that we would hope that the Chinese government or in other places in the world where this might be going on will take precautions to try to make this less likely from happening again. And even if COVID did come from that, I'm sorry, even if COVID did not come from that place, there is pretty solid proof that other viruses have developed in similar such environments. And I think it's important to realize that those are dangerous things, and we need to, and China, and again, which where a lot of these go on, has shown a great deal of ability to regulate things they don't like, in some ways in very dangerous and harmful ways. But goodness, they could certainly take a step on this if they wanted to. At the same time, if it does, we do learn someday that it was for certain a lab leak, there's a lot more that we could do to make those places safer. We know that there have been other viruses that have leaked from labs in the past. Certainly nothing as serious as this. There was a moratorium put in the United States on what's called gain of function research, which involves scientists tinkering with genes of viruses in a way that could make them more infectious. But there are some people who think it's possible that those studies could have been going on in Wuhan at that time. So I would argue that trying to figure this out, if it's at all possible, does matter. But even if both of these are still realistic possibilities, I think we should really try to address both of them, because the last thing we want is another pandemic coming through either of these channels.
Exactly. So it matters, because if we're really concerned about both preventing pandemics and addressing them effectively if a new virus arrives on the scene, that will help us be better prepared. But it also is important for the trustworthiness of the institutions. And we know that our public response depends a great deal on whether we believe what we're being told. And so I think for both those reasons, the answers really matter. You know, like, just be honest with us. Just tell us what's going on, even if you don't know. That's better than a carefully crafted message that is designed to get our compliance.
And one theory I've heard, and I don't know how much I buy into this, but that even though the Chinese in many ways are viewed as our enemy, there are smart, good scientists over there doing smart, good things. And in the academic community, they're not really looked at as our enemy. They're looked at as other scientists. And I've heard some people say that there may have been a bias in a way from scientists saying, oh no, our colleagues is probably not quite the right word, but people who are in the same line of work as us could not have been this sloppy and been hesitant to blame people who are kind of like them.
Yeah, that would be human nature. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that were the case.
One thing, too, is there's, again, as we hit any anniversary, there are oftentimes polls sort of looking back on how folks have reacted during these past 3 years now. One thing that did catch my eye is the study found that a quarter of parents in the United States admitted to lying about their child's COVID status, whether that was around other kids at daycare or certainly at schools. Did that number surprise you?
It surprised me at first. And then as I thought about it more, the isolation and quarantine guidance from the CDC that was implemented at many of the schools was such a mess. I mean, it was so hard to understand and interpret. And many times, like school officials, different school officials would interpret those guidelines in different ways. And so you had parents comparing to one another, you know, like one child, a sibling tested positive and they're going to school and the next one they can't and they have to stay out for 10 days.
Or maybe their district does that, but then the district across town or across the state handles it entirely differently.
Right. So you have all these inconsistencies and so at some point you have parents just kind of giving up and saying, I'm just going to trust. I know what's best for my kids and I'll just lie about it if I have to. I'm not excusing it. I'm just saying that's understandable when you have both confusing and inconsistent recommendations for how to proceed.
The only thing that surprised me, quite honestly, was that 25% of parents admitted to this. You know, I think...
Makes you wonder if there was a lot more that lied who didn't admit
exactly.
to it.
Exactly. I mean, there was some survey, how much you trust polling, but there was a survey I read the other day about the number of people who have admitted paying for sex. Well, I mean, the number was a low number, but that's a perfect example of something that very few people are going to respond, even on whatever surveying method is being used, to say, well, yeah, actually I have. And I don't, maybe paying for sex and hiding your child's COVID diagnosis are slightly different on a scale, but admitting wrongdoing to a survey taker is something that not everyone's comfortable in doing. So I was surprised that 25% were eager or at least willing to say yes.
It put me in mind of a really interesting conversation I had with parents of a college freshman, a young woman who was going to a university on the East Coast. So here she is in her first year and the campus is quarantined and she can't get together with her friends. And there's actually guidelines that prohibit them from getting together with other college students off campus as well. So this is during the winter, they invite their daughter and three or four friends to come to their house and they start a bonfire in the backyard and they have the kids gather together. I think it was maybe a half dozen, but sit around the bonfire outside and then lie about it, right? Because, right, that's what they're doing. And this isn't, K-12, this is college students and so forth. But my impression like that was, well, good. I mean, you kind of have to, like, looking out for you in a case like this. And normally we've had these discussions before about lying. You know, I normally say, like, no, that's something you just can't do. And yet that's perfectly understandable. I just think, like, this was a really hard time to be a parent. Tested a lot of boundaries. Now, I think if you know that if your child has tested positive or you have child siblings have tested positive and you have a child that comes down with symptoms or might be, and you send them to school, that's irresponsible. And there was a number of, in the survey, number of parents that admitted to doing that. That's just reprehensible because in that case, you are putting others at risk. But here's the other thing. I just think it shows that in cases like this, we need to think more about how does a society provide help for working parents for whom school, like during the school year, that's the place where the kids go. That's where they go for care. And a lot of them don't have backup plans or can't afford backup plans. And so maybe during a pandemic, we need to prepare for that. Like, are there places where children who are sick can go without infecting other kids? Because we know that a lot of parents are going to have no kind of financial or maybe concerns about safety, like might be financial or safety concerns. You know, they're going to end up sending their kids to school as the least worst option.
Before we close, Rick, it would be remiss if we didn't talk for a moment about vaccines. And that was probably one of the most polarizing things coming out of this pandemic. And you talk a bit about CDC messaging. And I think maybe the problem I saw out of that was that there were certain people, and I'll admit, I was one of these people who was just so excited to hear about the vaccines and was following that news so closely. And although I did not cut in line to get a vaccine, I was like at the front of the line to get a vaccine because I was convinced that getting the first and then getting the one 2 weeks later was just sort of the get out of jail free card and I could do what I wanted to do. And in fact, like 10 days after getting that second shot, we were on a plane to Phoenix to see friends we had not been able to see in a while because of the pandemic. And it just seemed like happy days were here again. And of course, what we learned over the past years since then was that, yeah, those shots offered some good protection, but it was not a guarantee or even a likelihood that you were not going to get the virus, that you probably still would, that you would probably have a better outcome than those who did not. But it was not this magic pill that I think a lot of people thought it might be. And again, I'm still 100% pro-vaccine, but I think sort of that change in outcome made people much more skeptical of the efficacy of the vaccines at all.
And many still are for yes. that reason. So we had this pattern, a real heavy emphasis on the effectiveness of washing one's hands and distancing, and then a gradual walking back of the effectiveness of both of those things. A real strong statements about the effectiveness and importance of masking, and then a kind of gradual walking back, and then real strong statements about the effectiveness of vaccines and then walking back. And you kind of see a pattern there. And this is really disastrous because what you're trying to do is establish trust, and you're making these really strong categorical claims that aren't supported by evidence, but you think are necessary in order to get everybody's compliance, which is important. Even if they're marginally effective, having everybody's compliance with these measures is really important for reducing the incidence and spread of COVID.
And as a term we learned quickly in the pandemic, to
flatten the curve. And so I like all of those things, like distancing, masking, and vaccines, all saved lives and reduced the incidence and the severity of the disease. And yet, I think because they were convinced that to make sure everybody realizes it's important, you have to overstate their effectiveness. And I think that's just wrong. By overstating their effectiveness and walking it back, you made all kinds of people skeptical about all of their claims, even the more modest ones. And so I would hope that our agencies have learned something from this. It's like, why weren't we saying from the very beginning, look, these vaccines are really remarkably effective, but they're going to be effective in the same way as the flu vaccine. It's going to make it less likely that you will contract the disease. And if you do, the symptoms will likely be less. Like, that's a great message. Yeah. And that would have, like, that's how we should have felt. That's how we should have gone into it. So I think there was an overemphasis on the messaging, not enough on like what scientists were actually talking about to themselves. I think they were much more cautious. The scientists I talked to were not making those kinds of bold claims. And so the very emphasis on the messaging ended up making the messaging less effective. Maybe we'll get that better next time.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Rick, what is your question for me?
Scott, you've been in journalism for a long time, and I know you've dealt with cases like this before. What do you do when someone asks you to remove a years-old story that mentions them doing something stupid or illegal or both? They claim to be a very different person now, but the story comes up whenever they are searched online, and it's keeping them from getting a good job.
You're exactly right that back when I worked in a newsroom, we would get these calls all the time. And I've worked in newsrooms long enough to tell you that over 20 years, the calls got more common. My policy always at the time was to ask a very straightforward question. And it would be, was there anything that is in our reporting that is either incorrect or incomplete? And rarely, if ever, did I hear anybody say anything that was incorrect. Occasionally, they would say there was something that was incomplete. Maybe they pled guilty to a lesser charge. Maybe the charges were possibly dropped. Any number of things that were made the story not as complete as it could be. Every time, of course, I would offer to correct anything that was incorrect. I don't remember that happening. I suppose it could have. Also, if there was a case where we did not follow the case to its conclusion, we would go back, check the court record, and update the story, not create a new story, but and not, you know, change the published time, but just say, you know, this story on, you know, one particular date, John Doe pled guilty to a misdemeanor after being charged with a Class B felony or whatever the case may have been. So there were times we would do that. Oftentimes, of course, that was not what they were hoping for. They were hoping to have me hit the delete button and this not to surface up again. I guess my thought on this has changed a little bit over the years. And again, I'm now speaking just for myself. I think our company policy, which I'm not, because I don't deal with these things on a regular basis, I'm not even exactly sure where it is right now, but we do have a legal department, and they often handle questions like this. But so I'll set, so setting aside any company policy, my own thoughts on this have changed a little bit, and I'll tell you why. It reminds me of a story that we ran in a newspaper I worked at many years ago about the reporter came back and she's like, oh, I have a great story. Well, what's the story? There was an woman in her 60s, she said, who in the middle of the afternoon walked in to a local drugstore in her house coat, carrying a machete, if I remember the details right, and making all sorts of ridiculous demands. I don't know if she even wanted money but she was just acting like she was not in her right mind. And of course, as you would expect, the employees at this drugstore were alarmed and called the police, and the police came. And again, I'm going off memory here, but my recollection is that the police were very familiar with this woman. She had lots of history of mental illness, and in this particular case, did not bring her to a jail, but brought her to a medical facility because clearly that was the help she needed. At some point during this process, I guess, and maybe they did bring her to the jail to book her, I don't remember the thing, but eventually brought her to the mental health facility, but we did get a booking shot of this woman. And it would not surprise you to learn that she was had a distinctive look about her. I think, you know, she just kind of, you know, a picture of someone who's a little, to use a term we're not supposed to use, a little crazy was how she looked. And I heard about this, and the reporter was like, I'll write this up, and this will just be a story that's going to get lots of web traffic. She wrote the story up, we published it, and it got a lot of web traffic. That was absolutely true. In retrospect, was that a story that we should have written? I don't know that it necessarily was, because she had not been, and if memory serves, never was charged with a felony. It was a story in the newspaper and online, not because of what charges came out of this, but because a woman in her 60s showing up in her house coat with a large knife at a drugstore, at least in our community, was unusual and kind of goofy. And that's why we published the story. And that may not have been, again, the right thing to do. I think it probably makes sense in my mind for newsrooms to have fairly solid standards about things like that. Clearly, if someone in your community is arrested for committing homicide, in most newsrooms I've worked in, thankfully, that's a big story because we don't have a lot of homicides where I've worked. That's something that is probably a pretty easy decision. And I think saying that we're going to give a certain amount of attention to people who are charged with certain crimes, and we typically play those, at least in the print product, in this part of the newspaper, not on page one necessarily, unless it happens to be a person of a particular note or a public figure. I think all of those are good policies to have in place so when something like that comes up, you know how to react. To go back to your question, though, I still lean on the side of not taking it down because our job as journalists are to provide accurate and complete coverage. And if it's accurate and not complete, our job is to make sure it is complete and we can update things. If our reporting standards change over time and that we decide that today we're going to cover things differently than we might have 10 years ago, well, I think that's probably fine too. I mean, I promise you, if you go back to newspapers of 75 or 100 years ago, the way crime was written about, the photos that accompanied those stories are things that you would never put online or in a mainstream newspaper today. So I think to say, well, just because we wouldn't have done it this way today, we should go back and apply those same standards 10 years ago is probably something I wouldn't feel comfortable doing. The last thing in my long monologue, and then I'll let you ask me some questions, and this is where I'm a little unsure about, but I want your opinion on, is in your scenario, this person did something either dumb or likely illegal and got in the newspaper, and now 10 years later is having a hard time finding a job. By the way, parenthetically, if your name is Jim Johnson, it's much better to be doing these things than if you have an unusual name, because of course there could be lots of Jim Johnsons and it's hard to know which one's which. But if you're one of those people with one of those names, the question I have for you is, we've talked a lot on this show about how people are much more comfortable talking about mental health issues, for example, and saying, you know, hopefully in most workplaces, being open and honest and saying, I have depression and here's how I'm handling that and here's how it's not going to affect me in this workplace. And or being honest about times that it does. And because we all know someone who has a mental illness, and there's probably not a family in this country who doesn't know about that. You could probably say the same thing about addiction issues as well. So the question I have, this is a very long windup and I apologize, is it possible to normalize in some way people who did make a mistake in their youth or maybe earlier in their lives? And should we, and recognizing that people do those things and can move on from them and become better people, is that not a useful exercise to demonstrate? And isn't really the true bad actor in this case the employer who's not giving that person a second chance?
Well, that very last question, I think that could be the case. The employer could be the bad actor. But I'm also wondering about the way in which the internet kind of makes everything present. So at one point, you know, the role of newspapers put things in print, and then you'd have the archived copies, which are, say, held at the library or, you know, in the newspaper offices and so forth.
A keyword search wasn't an option back then.
Right. But now all of that goes on with digital reporting is like it's instantly available. So something that happened 10 years ago, you put in the person's name and there it is again, and you're reading it, say, for the first time. Is not something you might have found out about, or you would have found out about it, but it would have appeared at least in a different context. And so then that makes me wonder if there's something to these, you know, claims are, is, does that become a form of punishment?
Well, and again, I'm only going to speak now for Wisconsin. I think every state has a little bit of a different situation. But in Wisconsin, there is a, maintained by the state, a court record site that will list whether you have been arrested for a first-degree homicide or whether you got a speeding ticket and everything else in between. So that information is out there. I mean, it's very bare bones information. You know, so and so was arrested, so and so went to court, and maybe a couple of steps along the way, found guilty, pled guilty, found not guilty, whatever the case might be. Does it give any of the
details? Information's out there anyway?
Yeah, and again, does that make it okay? I'm not, but also I will tell you, and again, I don't have those exact numbers in front of me, but in the state, that's not there forever. In the state, that information, they have a purge date. I think it's 20 years, maybe? That's kind of a guess, but it's about 20 years. That after 20 years, it goes away. If it's a misdemeanor, longer for felony, and I think like homicide might be 100 years. So, I mean, it doesn't go away while you're alive. But obviously, that is tougher for newspapers because we don't just automatically purge every story that's 20 years old because some of those could be interesting features about your mayor.
Did you ever purge a story?
No, I don't think I ever did. I paused because I think there were times where I cleaned things up, meaning like sometimes just through sloppiness, like four versions of a story were published. In that case, I would like click three of them off because we don't need, that's just sloppy web management. But right. Other than that, no.
Okay, yeah.
Would you do if, I mean, you're not a journalist, but obviously, what are your thoughts?
Well, you kind of made an implicit distinction there between crimes, so when you're doing legal reporting, and versus stories that might be like a human interest kind of story, but reflects badly upon a person. And you might want to apply different standards in those cases, especially where there's something like mental illness involved. And that makes a lot of sense to me that. But you also have to follow like the policies you have so that there's some consistency of response in regard to those claims.
And I also think you mentioned follow. I think it's important that as journalists, we follow those stories. So if we report on somebody being arrested, I think we've now raised our hand saying we're going to follow this story through the end. If this person's thrown in prison, if this person's found not guilty, that we now have taken ownership of this process. And I think that's something we should do.
For a while, I did a class for people who were in a diversion class from the courts for shoplifting. And there were some really kind of weird, kind of bizarre incidents of shoplifting. But those things are usually not covered by papers, that kind of crime. When would it be covered?
If the police chief were caught stealing a ham from the grocery store,
yeah.
It would be for so reasons.
If I it's think, a public figure.
Yeah, especially if it were like, you know, somebody in law enforcement. I mean, just like if the police chief were pulled over for first offense drunk driving, that's going to be a story versus if it were a regular person, I think, for reasons we all understand. And then the second one, so that's easier to explain. The second one is if it is just a hyper unusual circumstance. And I don't know what shoplifting that might be, but maybe if somebody stole a ham from the grocery store, this seems ridiculous, but was wearing a pig costume. Well, that's kind of crazy that somebody dressed up as a pig and then went in to steal a ham and then got arrested. I mean, but again, how do you weigh the sort of goofiness quotient that people are going to be like talking about versus like, well, the next day somebody robbed a ham from the store and weren't dressed a certain way, so we're not going to publicize that. That's to me where those can get trickier.
Well, I brought this up just because I remember we had talked about this years ago, and I was wondering if your thoughts had changed at all, given the way in which I think social media and electronic media in general has become much more pervasive in our lives. But it sounds like your decision-making criteria there is pretty much been the same.
Yeah, I think that going backward, it is the same. I think deciding how to cover things going forward is always a conversation good newsrooms and good journalists should have.
Yeah.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.